You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
On this week's tour around the NL Central, a return from injury has forced one of the Cardinals' established names down to the AAA level. It took nearly a full calendar year, but the Chicago Cubs have finally lost a game in which Jake Arrieta started. And the MLB draft begins on Thursday. We'll talk about all five teams' needs as the draft quickly approaches. We kick things off this week with Brewers reporter Adam McKelvey. Adam, as always, thank you for the time. And a decent week last week for the crew. They dropped a 2-3 against the always tough Cardinals, but then split a four-game series in Philadelphia against the Phillies. And definitely some positive things to talk about, particularly in the bullpen. But as we so often do, I want to begin with the mystery that is Willie Peralta. Another rough outing on Sunday. He did not make it through the fifth. Gave up six runs, five earned, if memory serves. His ERA on the season now 6.79. I know that Craig Counsell came right out and said, you know, he's not going to lose his spot in the rotation. We're going to stick with him. He's going to find his way through this. You know, at this point, he's been given a lot of chances. Is this the right move by the Brewers to continue to give him chances?
Well, look, I'll tell you the logic, because it's sort of the same as when we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. It's number one, this is a guy who two seasons ago, for an entire major league season, was their best pitcher. And he won 17 games. He had a 3.5 ERA for a full season and was really looking like a young power pitcher who was turning the corner. Now, he had injuries last year that ruined it, and this season he has just been bad from the start. But that 3.53 ERA from 2 years ago, it's not gone. The talent that produced that is not just gone forever. And the Brewers are trying to figure out the best way to get it back. Because it's in their interest for this year and beyond as they look to trade assets. And it's in Willie Peralta's best interest. So what is the best way to get it back? And I think the same four options are on the table. It's option him to the minors, bump him back a start or two, move him to the bullpen, or continue to pitch him. And they have, for now, said they're going to continue to pitch him. And I think one of the main factors driving that is there hasn't been a better option screaming at him. And I think that's one of the main issues right now is their top prospect, Jorge Lopez, has not pitched well at AAA. Taylor Youngman, who got demoted earlier, is not pitching well at all at AAA. And some of the other guys on the 40-man roster are just they're still in need of some minor league time. So they don't have a great option screaming at him. At the same time, they feel like continuing to pitch him is in the best interest of Peralta finding a rhythm. So that's why they're going to continue to do it for now. Now, look, at some point, you can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over. And at some point, they will make some kind of change. And I think we're coming up on that in about 8 days as we sit here, Matt, and talk. You've got Matt Garza coming back. He's got one more minor league rehab outing. Then he's ready for his season debut. And now he's coming off a season last year that's just like Willie Peralta's this year, but he says he's felt really good. The stuff feels great. The body feels great. The Brewers are invested in him financially. He's going to make starts for this team. You're going to have to find a spot for him in the rotation. And that may be the time when now, yes, they do have an option instead of Willie Peralta. And these two pitchers might be tied here.
You know, is it a case with Peralta right now where it's just kind of a mental thing? It's between his ears, and is it that old, you know, catch 22 where you can't pitch well unless you have confidence, but you can't have confidence until you pitch well? Is that kind of the vicious cycle he's stuck in right now?
It probably is, Matt, because talking to Jonathan Lucroy, the catcher, after the most recent outing, he says when the stuff's down, it's as good as anything you see in Major League Baseball. And there are pitches in these games that are down like that, and your eyes open a little bit, and you go, all right, here we go. That's Lucroy talking. It's the fact there are too few of those pitches, and the ones that are up are just hammered. That's what's killing Willie Peralta. And the fact he's not getting away with any mistakes, you know, sometimes that is what happens when it's a pitcher whose confidence is down. But look, how do you get confidence when you're not getting results? That's been the cycle and the problem that they faced all season, and so far they haven't found any relief.
Yeah, it's been a season-long struggle to find answers for Willie Peralta, who, as you said, as recently as 2 years ago was so good, a winner of 14, 15 games, the ERA around 3.5. So, like you said, that pitcher still exists. It's a matter of finding him. And, Adam, as you brought up, Matt Garza, one more rehab start before he is set to rejoin the Brewers' rotation at the big league level. And, you know, we've discussed in recent weeks that this rotation as a whole has really turned things around. Jimmy Nelson has been solid pretty much all year. He's been their most consistent starter by far. Zach Davies, as of late, little hiccup his last outing, but before that had been really effective. Junior Guerra's done nothing to not deserve his spot in the rotation. So, like you said, where does Garza kind of fit into this puzzle? Is it a matter of when he is healthy? Is that going to be, you know, do they have to draw a line of the sand at that point with Peralta?
Well, yeah, I mean, right now I think there's two options. Zach Davies is just experience-wise, service time, establishedness. He's the low man on the totem pole. So all other things being equal, he'd probably be the guy who goes out when Garza comes in. But look, you've got Willy Peralta struggling so bad. He does have an option remaining. He does not have the service time necessary to have a say in the matter. So if they want to option him out at that time, they could. So I think it's going to depend on, you know, Zach Davies starts. We're sitting here talking on Tuesday. Zach Davies is about to pitch. Then he'll pitch once more before the Brewers reach this decision point. So if Davies pitches well in those two games, and he pitched great in his most recent start against the Cardinals, eight of the best innings the Brewers have gotten all season from a starting pitcher. If he puts a couple more outings, anything like that together, that's a really hard sell to your fans to send him down when you've got a guy like Willy Peralta struggling so bad. So Davies has a chance to have a say in this, I think, by just continuing to perform.
Adam, thank you so much for the time. And the first thing I want to say regarding Sunday's game is that the only knowledge I have of the game is from the 60-second highlight package that our outstanding MLB.com crew put together. In other words, I did not watch the entire game. So, therefore, I don't know the circumstances that led to Albert Pujols with his Angels team down a run, facing a left-hander in the eighth inning with the Pirates trying to protect that one-run lead. Pujols, of course, homers. Angels go on for the 5-4 comeback win after trailing 4-1 in the seventh inning. So please explain to me why Tony Watson was the choice in that spot instead of a right-hander to face the dangerous Pujols.
Well, yeah, Tony Watson is their go-to setup man. He's been one of the better eighth-inning pitchers in baseball over the last couple of years. So the Pirates really haven't shied away from him against any handed batter. I think he's had success against pretty much everyone. Although that was heading into this year. The interesting thing is he struggled a little bit at times this season. He had kind of a rough patch right out of the gate. Really got it back together in a great stretch in May where he barely gave up a hit, much less a run. And then the last couple of times out, he's just been a little bit shaky. He said it doesn't have to do with, you know, necessarily mechanics or stuff. His velocity's fine and all that. It's just been a pretty simple matter of pitch execution. He's leaving balls out over the plate, up in the zone, as you saw that the Pujols homer was actually like way above the zone. It was kind of an unusual pitch to swing at, but I mean, Pujols still has that kind of power. He's killed the Pirates over the years, so it was no real surprise to see him get a hold of that one, but it has been odd to see Watson struggle the way that he has at times this season.
Now, even though, you know, Albert Pujols is not the Albert Pujols of 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, did it still kind of raise some eyebrows that, you know, as good as Watson's been, despite the recent struggles, that you're still talking a lefty-righty matchup here in a crucial spot in that game?
No, I don't think so. Clint Hurdle's not necessarily a batter-by-batter kind of manager when it comes to his pitching staff, but especially a guy like Watson, you need to be able to trust him with not only the eighth inning, but the heart of the lineup in the eighth inning. You know, we saw Watson pitch a little bit in the seventh earlier this season because it was based on leverage. Essentially, if it's not Mark Melanson facing the heart of another team's order, they want it to be Tony Watson. And you saw him get through, I believe it was Calhoun and Trout, pretty well. You know, Trout's obviously about as dangerous as a right-handed hitter as you can find, but then just couldn't get through Pujols. And like I said, it was a weird pitch that he hit. It was leaving that ball so high up in the zone. It wasn't like he missed right out over the heart of the plate. Just a really high pitch. Pujols didn't miss it. Maybe he had a better look at it because it was a lefty as opposed to a righty. But I think the Pirates' more pressing concern is getting Watson back on track so that they can trust him in those situations. Otherwise, maybe, I don't know, maybe you see Neftali Feliz a little bit more in those higher leverage moments.
Yeah, definitely a tough loss for the Pirates. They were on their way to taking two or three games in that series against the Angels. They led 4-1 in the seventh. Gerrit Cole on the mound. He gives up two runs, and then Watson gives it away in the eighth, and the Pirates end up losing 5-4. They had a great chance in the ninth, I believe, bases loaded for Sean Rodriguez, only one away against a guy in Houston Street that just came back. But Street got him on the double play, and it was just that kind of a week for the Pirates. They've lost 5 of 6 games, but breaking down those losses, Adam, 3 of the 5 losses only came by one run. Another loss came by 2 runs, only one blowout in that mix, a 9-2 loss to the Angels in there. Now, of course, that's a little consolation for the fans and for the players because L's are L's no matter what. But is it more of a feeling right now that the Pirates are just kind of catching a few bad breaks? They've had some bad luck on their side as opposed to the, you know, maybe just playing poorly over this stretch?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of bad luck, but I think if you're concerned about anything, it's kind of what we were talking about a couple weeks ago. It's still the rotation. Francisco Liriano doesn't look like an opening day starter, much less number one or two. He's really badly struggled. Juan Nicasio has not been reliable heading out there every fifth day. That's something they kind of need to address, whether it's specifically with Nicasio, with a Justin Masterson type waiting in AAA, or with one of their top pitching prospects at some point, is shoring up that rotation. Because I mean, they've had to use a lot of long relievers. They've been switching out guys in and out of the bullpen, and they haven't really found a lot of success anywhere but Mark Melancon and occasionally Neftali Feliz. So pitching's still an issue. The offense has turned down a little bit since that great first month they had. Somebody like Jordy Mercer has come back down to earth a little bit. Francisco Cervelli's not hitting for the same kind of power. And Andrew McCutchen is still kind of a mystery at this point. He told us in Miami that he's been sort of nursing a swollen thumb, and he showed it to us. It looked like he had a golf ball in between the forefinger and thumb on his hand. So that's a little bit of a concern. If he can't grip the bat and he's getting jammed inside, that's still an issue. It's been some bad luck, but there are still a lot of indicators that this team is not playing up to its full potential at this point of the season.
Jennifer here on the East Coast. It is about 4:15, and some breaking or recently developing news, if you want to look at it that way, that you just informed me of. The Cardinals have just optioned Colton Wong down to AAA, I believe, as Johnny Peralta is on his way back. So he's kind of the odd man out here, and we were just discussing how, you know, this guy just signed a 5-year extension in the offseason, and he was, you know, on the fast track, and now he's not even on the major league roster. So just discuss this. Rather, I don't want to call it stunning, but certainly a name like that to see him option to AAA, it certainly is. It catches you off guard a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it is stunning in the respect that, I mean, as you mentioned, the Cardinals signed this guy to be a part of their long-term core, and there was never an expectation coming into the year that Colton would be anything but this team's everyday second baseman. And then, of course, a kid by the name of Aledmys Diaz comes up, and the way he has played has changed the Cardinals' plans dramatically. I mean, Johnny Peralta getting hurt in spring training opened up that shortstop position. Ruben Tejada getting hurt the final day of spring training gave Aledmys Diaz the chance that he has seized, and now the Cardinals want to keep Diaz at short. So what that means is that all sorts of pieces have to move around. You see Johnny Peralta, he's going to move to third base. Matt Carpenter, who was at third base, he's going to move to the right side of the infield. He could have played first, but with the way Matt Adams is hitting right now, Cardinals have no need to take him out of the lineup. And so then you look at second base, haven't gotten great production there out of Colton Wong, so that's where Matt Carpenter is going to fit. And the Cardinals wanted to send Colton Wong down to Memphis, you know, really for the sole reason of the ability he could have there to get everyday at bat. I mean, if he were to stay on this major league roster, sure, he could help off the bench. He could pitch, hit, spot, start from here, you know, here and again. But for him to get right, for him to get his swing right, and he's been working through the mechanics of that swing all year, particularly with his leg kick, he needs to play. And the only place for him to do that is down in Memphis. Now, is this a hit to the ego? I'm sure it is. He hasn't been down in the minors since 2013. But, you know, it could work out for him. We'll see when or if he comes back up this year. And the Cardinals, you know, one of the things that they have emphasized is that they still do see Colton Wong as a part of their long-term future. It's just a matter of where he's going to fit and how soon he can find that fit again.
Yeah, and you just brought up a good point, something I wanted to elaborate on. Knowing him as you do, you know, here's a young guy. He's got his whole career ahead of him. He was projected to be the starting second baseman for this team for years and years to come down the road. Signed that big extension, and now he's in AAA. And again, knowing him as you do and through your experiences with him, you know, is this going to be something devastating for him, or does he have kind of the mindset where he says, you know what, okay, it's a setback, no question, but I have enough confidence in my abilities to know that I'm going to get my stroke back in AAA and be back with the big club in no time?
Yeah, this is a huge crossroads for him, because Colton is a guy that since he came up, he's very hard on himself. He expects perfection of himself. He might go 4 for 5 in a game, and he will go home and lament over that one at-bat that did not go right, and that's just how he's wired. And, you know, it's helped him get to this point, helped him, you know, thrive in the minor leagues, certainly. But that being said, a guy who is so hard on himself and puts so much pressure on himself, how is he going to react to being sent down to AAA is something I don't even think the Cardinals know. And you know, I think the way in which he reacts is going to dictate how this goes. If he takes this as an opportunity to get himself right, maybe play in a less pressurized situation where he can just go out and let his natural talent shine, he can get back on track. I mean, he still is a very talented second baseman. I think he has defensive potential to be above average at the position, and certainly the offensive potential to be a weapon. So it's all going to be in how he sees this. You know, that being said, the other way you can go is to just feel sorry for yourself, to wonder where your fit is going to be. And, you know, and at that point, you do then wonder where his career goes. So maybe he'll get a little bit of advice, or maybe he has right from Jed Jerko, who another infielder on this team who went through this exact same thing last year when he was with San Diego. He had signed a long extension with the Padres after a great rookie season. All of a sudden, he didn't produce over the first 2 months of the season, and he found himself back in AAA, spent about a month down there, came back up, and had a much better finish. So if Colton can channel this correctly, I do think it can be a benefit. But again, this is a guy who, you know, there's a lot of mental noise that can get to him, so he's going to have to make an effort to make sure that this is something he can make a positive.
He kind of reminds me of Paul O'Neill with the Yankees back in their heyday in the 90s. You know, like you said, Colton Wong can go 4 for 5 and kick himself over the one at bat. He did not get on base. Paul O'Neill was wired the same way, so we saw what kind of a career Paul O'Neill had, and hopefully that is in the cards for Colton Wong going down the road. But for right now, definitely a setback for him, as he is no longer on the major league roster because of all the shuffling going on. He is the odd man out. To go back to the kind of the original point about, you know, why Wong is no longer with the big league team, it is because of Aledmys Diaz. He's been so great at short. Johnny Peralta is on his way back. Now, you said Peralta is going to be taking over third base, which now puts Matt Carpenter on the right side, primarily at second base. But focusing here on Peralta, he has played third base, I think, over 200 games in his career, but he has not played third since 2010, back with the Tigers when he split 2010 between the Tigers and the Indians. How concerning is that for a team that has had their defensive struggles this year, especially on the infield?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how quickly he can take to the position. I mean, he played it a little bit in his most recent rehab assignment that he had, but he only logged 27 innings at third base, so we're not talking about a very big sample size. He does have experience, and the thing that Johnny always brought to that shortstop position was stability. He made all the plays that he should. Maybe he didn't have exceptional range, or he wasn't going to be a Gold Glove shortstop, but he made the plays he needed to, and I think that's the hope for the Cardinals at third base, that he'll just have sure enough hands that he can take care of what needs to be done. And let's be honest, I mean, Matt Carpenter hasn't looked that great defensively at third base for the Cardinals, and we've talked a lot about their defensive issues at shortstop, but they've had plenty of issues as well at third base, where Matt Carpenter right now is second among third basemen in errors committed this year. So the hope is that Johnny can, again, stabilize that a little bit. I think he'll be fine. He seems to adapt very well to whichever way he goes. And, you know, he was open to this. And that's one of the things that the Cardinals made sure to do before moving these pieces around, is they talked to Johnny Peralta, made sure he was okay moving to third. They talked to Matt Carpenter. He agreed that it would be a good option for him to move to the right side of the infield. So the Cardinals have buy-in from all of these players. Now it's just a matter of seeing how they can react to shuffling around.
Chris, we can't thank you enough for coming on board today to talk Reds baseball. And, of course, Chris, you know, it's no secret the Reds are having a very difficult 2016, but I got to think that last week was maybe their high point of the season, or at least their high point in the last 2 months. They took 5 of 7 games from the Rockies in Colorado, 3 out of 4, and then they nearly swept the Nationals if a ninth-inning comeback on Sunday did not fall just short. It's only 1 week, and it's only a 7-game sample, but I got to think that for all the difficulties this Reds team has been through, at one point losing 12 out of 13, to just have a week and have a stretch where there was not constant negativity had to do this team a world of good.
Well, I think you're right on the button there, Matt. I can tell you that, you know, this is a rebuilding year for the Reds, and the fans know that, and the Reds have reached out to their fans and asked them to be patient during this whole rebuilding area, be rebuilding year or years. But if you're a player on the team, you don't want to hear that. I mean, you're in the big leagues maybe for the first time, maybe you're just hanging on, or maybe you're on a multi-year contract. You don't want to go out there and lose on a nightly basis, especially get embarrassed by giving up leads late in the ball game or getting blown out. So the reversal began when the Reds really went through Milwaukee and then played very good baseball in Denver against the Rockies and came back, and they took that momentum right against the Washington Nationals, who were atop the division when they saw them. And it was kind of interesting because there were a lot of emotions going on with Dusty Baker coming back to Cincinnati, the Nationals bringing in, you know, Gia Gonzalez and Steven Strasburg in the first couple of starts, and the Reds ran both of them out of there. So it was very interesting the way the Reds have been able to finally put some things together and feel good about themselves as a team, which, if you've ever played athletics, that's what you want. In a team sport, you want the whole team to feel good.
Yeah, you brought up a good point that, you know, it's one thing for the team to convey a message to the fan base and say, you know, look, we're going to have our bumps on the road. Be patient. This is a process. But like you said, it's a much different emotional state with the players themselves. You know, how have, you know, in your dealings with the veterans on this team, the Brandon Phillipses and the Joey Votto's and Jay Bruce's, how trying has it been for these guys who have had success and have a track record of success, not just from a team standpoint, but individually too, to kind of keep their heads up and display for the younger guys, you know, what it means to be a professional, even when things aren't going well?
Well, that's a key word, being a professional. But at the same time, you're thinking, hey, these guys like Votto and Bruce and Phillips and Cozart, I mean, just a few years ago, they were in the playoffs three out of the last 5 years. So, you know, you're wondering, well, what the heck happened and how are they going to handle the team that is supposedly going to lose 90 to 100 games this year? But they've been very professional. You try to lead in your clubhouse. You try to lead on the bench and of course, lead in the field as well. But they like things when they get turned around. Obviously, the main problems the Reds have had this year have been related to their pitching, especially their relief pitching. And, you know, if they start getting better starting pitching and they don't have to go to the bullpen as early, the offense is coming around a little bit. Votto is hitting the ball much better now than he did in the beginning of the year when he was hovering around the 200 mark. And I think that can be, you know, everybody kind of wants to get into the act when that happens. And I think that's where they are right now. But, you know, these veteran players aren't going to give up. They know that they've got more than one responsibility. They've got a responsibility to themselves, to the fans, to their teammates. And you try to go out and give your best every day, no matter.
And, Chris, I want to backtrack just a little bit. You brought up this past weekend not only the Nationals in town with all their star-studded power in the lineup and on the pitching staff, but that meant the return of Dusty Baker as well. Dusty with the Reds for six successful seasons, three of those years, took them to the postseason. How was Dusty greeted by the fan base at Great American Ballpark, and how did Dusty feel himself upon returning to his old stomping grounds?
Well, Dusty felt probably, let me cover that for, he was happy to come back here, number one. I think Dusty felt like he was maybe somewhat misunderstood as a Reds manager, that maybe underappreciated would be a better term, because Dusty, you know, did lead them to the playoffs. It had been a long drought since the Reds had been there, and Dusty was at the helm when they went back. And I think because they didn't get any deeper into the playoffs than they did was the reason why Dusty was let go. So he looks at the Reds now compared to when he was here and say, see, maybe he wasn't the manager after all. He didn't voice those things, but you can kind of tell by talking to Dusty. That's probably where he was coming from. The fans like Dusty here. You know, they appreciated what he did here. He was always a very fan-friendly. He was a guy that was always got the most out of his players. So I think that his trip back to Cincinnati, other than the two losses and the near sweep that the Nationals had here at Great American Ballpark, was very nice.
And why was it that, you know, Dusty was underappreciated at times during his six-year tenure? I know you brought up the main reason was that I think the expectations from the fan base that, okay, the postseason's great, we want more, we want a pennant, we want a world championship. Was it merely that, or were there other factors involved?
I think that was probably only the fact they didn't get deep into the playoffs. Two of the playoff appearances of the three that they had were one-game playoffs that they had to play in Pittsburgh against the Pirates. So that was one bad thing there. The other part of it was that when they finally did make the next round in the playoffs, they went out to San Francisco. They won their first two games, and they just needed one more win. San Francisco came in here, and the Giants swept the Reds three straight before going on to win the World Series. So that was something that really left a bad taste in everybody's mouth. You know, you start second-guessing the manager. You start cutting and slicing every game, pitch by pitch, of what the manager did wrong as far as substitutions and so on. So I think that that's part of the problem that the Reds fans had with Dusty, is that he never was able to get them over the hump their expectations may have exceeded the ability of the ball club. You don't really know. But at the same time, you can't tell fans that. Once you get into the postseason, they want to go all the way.
Len, thank you so much for joining us on this Monday. And I guess a fitting theme for Sunday would be all good things at some point come to an end. And Jake Arrieta starting for this team is almost always a good thing for the better part of a year. Losing for the first time since July 25th of 2015, his streak of 20 straight winning decisions comes to an end. That was the third longest streak in baseball history. And Len, is it one of those cases where, you know, during a streak like this, it's hard to appreciate when the streak is ongoing, but now that it's over, can you kind of sit back and look at the whole thing and say, my God, that was impressive?
Well, I think, Matt, you know, our job as broadcasters is to try to put things into perspective as they're going on. And, you know, I really tried to remember how unlikely and improbable and almost impossible it is to do what Jake did during this 24-start stretch. You know, he always gives your team a chance to win. He threw seven shutout innings in his previous start, got a no decision. The team took the loss. And then yesterday, he had 12 strikeouts in five innings. Nine hits, 10 balls were put in play, and nine ended up hits. So there was maybe some bad luck involved, and I suppose you could claim that along the way at some point maybe he got a little good luck. He gave up a two-run hit in the game yesterday. It was only the second two-run hit he has allowed all year. So it's not only rare to see him give up runs and take a loss, but it's something nobody had seen him really do much in the last almost 10 months. So, yeah, I do appreciate it. I think we did appreciate it as it was going on, but as time moves on, we'll probably look back and wonder if it'll ever happen again.
Yeah, one of the most dominant stretches in baseball history, no question. And you brought up the very strange line that he had on Sunday, only the five innings, nine hits and 12 strikeouts. So is it fair to say, as odd as this will sound, that he was both dominant and very hittable at the exact same time?
Yeah, and I thought the Diamondbacks had a pretty good approach. They made him throw a lot of pitches. Michael Bourne led off the game and actually struck out, but it was on the 10th pitch, and that really seemed to set the tone. I think Jake had thrown over 50 pitches through two innings, so it kind of felt early like it was not going to be a long day for him. Yet he kept missing bats. He was throwing a 97-mile-an-hour sinker. And again, give the Diamondbacks credit. Patrick Corbin also pitched a little better than Jake did and can now claim that, you know, he's the first guy since Cole Hamels actually beat him, although in Hamels' case last year it was a no-hitter. So
right.
You have to be really, really good to beat Jake Arrieta.
Yeah, no question there. And, you know, when talking with our Cubs reporter, Carrie Muscat, over these past few weeks, you know, she tells us, and people echo the same sentiment, that Jake Arrieta is not wired like your normal average athlete. You know, he wants perfection every time. He wants to throw a perfect game every time. So knowing this, and I'm sure you would, you know, agree with that assessment of him, what was his attitude after the game yesterday? Because I think some athletes would say, you know what, at some point the law of averages catches up to you and these things have to end. Or is he a guy that still is breathing fire, knowing that, you know what, I could have been better, I could have done this differently, we still should have won? How did he kind of take his first loss in forever?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both, although I don't think he looks back and has too many regrets. And I think that's part of what has made him so good, is that whether he wins, whether he throws a no-hitter, whether it's a no-decision, or like yesterday a loss, I think his attitude is, what do I need to do in 5 days to go out and in this case beat the Atlanta Braves in his next start? So I think he realizes he had really good stuff yesterday and understood that the Diamondbacks were going to make him throw early strikes and work hard to get them out. But he's just going to move ahead and get ready for his next outing, and I'm sure he'll be the same old Jake Arrieta.
Yeah, unfortunately for the Atlanta Braves, as far as they're concerned, no question. And, you know, it hardly goes unnoticed, one of those things that makes baseball so beautiful and so quirky, so unpredictable. Here the Cubs are. They finish off a 10-game homestand. They lose twice. The two games they lose are the Jake Arrieta starts. I mean, what are the odds of that, considering how dominant he's been? But to that, you know, to that end, in that vein, Joe Maddon commented after the game that, you know what, there was some visible, you know, frustration and anger, not just by Arrieta, but by his players, knowing that, you know what, we should have finished things off. We should have finished the homestand 9-1 instead of 8-2. There's still 26 games over 500, something ridiculous. But when you look at how well they've played, and how easy it would be to let complacency set in, you know, how encouraging is it to know that this Cubs team no matter, you know, how many wins they accumulate, no matter how many times they lap the field, they still want to get better each and every single day.
Well, I think it's process-driven, number one. And number two, they like being greedy. There have been a lot of series this year in which they've won the first two games. And a lot of teams would feel comfortable with winning two out of three. But they've gone on to engineer the sweep. I think they've got six series sweeps along the way, something ridiculous like that. And, yeah, they know they're good. They come to the ballpark expecting to win every single day. And I think a lot of people in the ballpark, and certainly in the clubhouse yesterday, even though they were down 3-2 for the final, I think, four innings, they felt that the Cubs were going to come back and win that game. It didn't work out that way. You can't win every single game. But when you follow the team like we do every single day, it starts to feel that way, that they are going to win every single game. And, yeah, you'll take 8-2 on every homestand or every 10-game segment the rest of the way, and you're probably looking at well over a 100-win team. But where they sit in the standings right now, what their record is, I don't think the players care about that as much as just going out and winning a ball game today.